Right, good morning, everybody. Before we begin, I want to note that this morning's talk is sponsored by Mr. Kenny Wintman in honor of his sister Sandy Welk's special birthday. May we all be blessed with good health to 120. Thank you for your sponsorship, Kenny. We usually get about 175 people in this class, so we're a little on the low end, but I don't want to keep you all waiting, so we are going to get started. Today, we are going to be looking at 1 Maccabees and 2 Maccabees. You can easily access these texts at one of many websites, but I like to use bible.aremus.org. Of course, these texts are preserved in the Apocrypha, which is widely available online, although qualities of translation vary from text to text, which is why I recommend the Jewish Annotated Apocrypha. And if you have it, I would pull it out. Now, many of us don't realize that there is only one eyewitness account to the Hasmonean Rebellion, which took place in 167 to 164 BC. There's one eyewitness account, and that's 1 Maccabees. We have 2 Maccabees, which is a totally different work. And if you open up any Apocrypha, you'll see 3 Maccabees and 4 Maccabees, and these are not stories about the Maccabees. 3 Maccabees is, I think I've mentioned it in the past, is sort of a parallel Esther story, but it takes place in Alexandria about the plot of Ptolemy to annihilate the Jews of Egypt. While it parallels Esther in many ways, it also shares themes with the Maccabean heroes, but it's not an account of the Maccabean rebellion. 4 Maccabees is a philosophical treatise, which was written by an Alexandrian Jew deeply influenced by Stoic thinking. So really, when we're talking about ancient histories of the Hasmonean Rebellion, we're talking about 1 Maccabees, which is an eyewitness, and 2 Maccabees, which is absolutely not an eyewitness. And then we have other texts which recall the story, but much later. So we have Josephus in the late first century, who's definitely using 1 Maccabees, probably did not have 2 Maccabees, but Josephus has sources and he's using those sources. Obviously, he did not live through the rebellion himself. And then we have the rabbinic retelling of the story, most famously in Shabbat, which maybe we'll get to if we have time, but it's just one little paragraph that starts with "My Hanukkah, why do we celebrate Hanukkah?" But so the most important thing that I want to start out with is with this reality that we have one eyewitness to the story. And is this eyewitness objective? No, because there's no such thing as objective history in the ancient world. There's no historian who's writing exactly every detail as if it's a dry archive without any sort of side polemic. Every history in the ancient world wants to make an argument, often to legitimize the hero of the story, who may or may not, in fact, have actually been a hero. And 1 Maccabees is no different from these other histories. It was written likely by an insider of the Hasmonean court who commissioned the writing of this work sometime in the second half of the second century BCE. It was preserved in Greek, it circulated in Greek, but it was almost certainly written originally in Hebrew, again, by a member of the Hasmonean court. It focuses on the heroics of Judah Maccabee and his brothers and his father, Matithiah. If you had a chance to read it, you'll see it's heavily focused on arguing for the heroism and the legitimacy of the Hasmonean family. And if this is a late second century BC work, then it's very significant because at this time, the Hasmonean family is kind of in shambles. By the end of the second century BCE, the Hashmonaim are no longer these pious anti-Hellenist vagabonds who are running through the countryside. Instead, they're massively wealthy. They've expanded their empire. Some of them are Hellenized themselves. And so the Hasmonean world and leadership of the late second century BC is very, very, very different than the Hasmonean family of 167 BCE. A lot can happen in a half century. And so arguing for the legitimacy of the Hasmonean family and their integrity is work that needs to be done in the second century, at the end of the century, when there are Jews, probably Pharisees, but observant Jews who are very disenchanted with the Hasmonean family. And so this book focuses on the integrity and the legitimacy of the Hasmonean family. Again, written in Judea, probably in Jerusalem, written in Hebrew. Two Maccabees, totally different work. First of all, this writer probably did not know Hebrew. He identifies himself as Jason of Cyrene in modern day Libya. Maybe never went to Israel, we don't know, or the land of Judea. Certainly this is a diasporan work. It's also a theological work. The writer is less interested in the individuals comprising the Hasmonean family and their heroic and pious status, and more interested in the affairs of the temple, the broad structure of leadership, whether that's leadership of the Hasmoneans or of others. But most importantly, the author of Two Maccabees wants to make the argument that this is not just a story about a war between some regional Jews and some regional Syrian Greeks, but this is a story of an imminent culture clash that was bound to happen because Hellenism stands in opposition to Judaism. And these are words that are coined by the author of Two Maccabees. And I should say before I go on, the compositional history of Two Maccabees is very complicated because we actually don't have the original text. We have a document that says, I found this text. It was a 5-volume account written by Jason of Cyrene. 5 volumes, massive work. I found it and I condensed it. And what we have is the condensed version. So if you're a careful reader of this text, you'll see that this is actually not the original version. This is a condensed version. So we could speak of the author and then we could speak of the condenser. But we had the condensed version. So when I talk about Jason, it could be, you know, it could be that what I'm talking about is really the work of the condenser. I'm assuming that the condenser did not add material. In other words, a few decades after this text was written, it was a 5-volume text. It became lost. It was not circulated. Like, who wants to walk around with 5 volumes of details of the Hasmonean Rebellion? But a Greek-speaking Jew, we don't know his name, condensed the work. I'm assuming he didn't add material, but he eliminated material. Now, if you open up any work of Two Maccabees, you'll also see that it opens up with two letters. I think that I've spoken about this in past weeks. These two letters have nothing to do with the work. So the first 10 verses of 10 Maccabees are an ancient letter written from Jews in Judea to Jews in Jerusalem, trying to convince them to observe Hanukkah. And then from chapter 1, verse 10 through chapter 2, verse 18, we have a second letter, also an ancient late second century BC letter from Judean leaders to Egypt, trying to convince them to observe the holiday of Hanukkah. So we have these two letters that were attached. And the story actually begins in chapter 2, verse 19. If you have questions, maybe put them in the chat. So the story begins in 2 Maccabees, chapter 2, verse 19. And again, we are dealing with a revised version of the original work. So it's complicated. But again, when we look at 2 Maccabees, we're looking, I have to mute everybody. Okay. So I don't hear anything today. Like, I don't hear any. All right. How do I do that? Hold on 1 second. You know what? First, because I'm challenged. Oh, okay. There. Everybody. Okay. For some reason, I wasn't getting any of that, but you all hear me, right? Yeah. Okay. Perfect. Thank you for everybody who's waving to me. Okay. Okay. Great. And I'm not really going to be checking the chat. So, you know, I would appreciate, as always, if you could put your questions and comments in the chat towards the end, the second half of the talk, that would be great because it pops up, but I don't have time to read as I'm talking. So the second half of the class, I'd love to see your questions and comments, but let's try to push it to the end if you can. Okay. So again, 1 Maccabees, Judean, Hebrew, written by an insider of the Hasmonean court, focused on the heroics and legitimacy of the Hasmonean family. 2 Maccabees is a Greek diasporan work that is theological. It's making an argument that's theological, that Judaism, a word that had never been used before the writer uses it in Greek, judaismos, is pitted against Hellenismos, Hellenism. Another word that did not exist. Greeks did not use this word, Hellenism. right? Religion and the category of religious communities did not exist in the way that it exists in contemporary times. Hellenism and Judaism are words that the author coins. When we teach our children, or at least when I teach my children or watch them being taught at Yeshiva Day School, this notion that Judaism operates in conflict with Hellenism is organic to the Hanukkah story. It's almost like that's the baseline upon which we scaffold the story. And yet that's not necessarily how those who experienced it, and those who are reading 1 Maccabees, interpreted the story. It was a war. It was a war that was miraculously won thanks to divine intervention, sure. But was it a war that recognizes or that symbolizes Judaism's total opposition to Hellenism? That's an argument that the writer of 2 Maccabees makes that may not actually be endemic to the story, but it's a very, very powerful argument. And it's interesting, again, because 2 Maccabees is not immediately popular, right? So again, we don't think that Josephus had it. The rabbis don't seem to have had it. And yet the ideas articulated in 2 Maccabees at some point become very, very foundational to our interpretation of the story. And most ironically, soon I'm going to share my screen, but I just want to say one more thing. Most ironically, of all the works that we have in the Apocrypha, and I would say many of these works are originally written in Judea and the land of Israel, and of those, some are written in Hebrew. So we have a diasporan work written in Greek. Of all the works preserved in the Apocrypha, this Greek diasporan text is the most anti-Greek work that survives from the period of the Second Temple period. So of all the Jewish texts that I have read, 2 Maccabees is the most anti-Greek. Now, why is this interesting? First of all, because it's diasporan and it's written in Greek, but the writer uses the most beautiful Greek you could imagine, stylistically sophisticated, pulls out all the stops, uses techniques that we see in the most popular of plays, pathos and soliloquy and anything you can imagine that would take place in the Greek stage is employed by 2 Maccabees. So ironically, 2 Maccabees is highly, highly educated. Jason of Cyrene gets a great education in Greek philosophy and Greek stylistics and literature, and takes all those tricks and then throws it against Hellenism and says, I'm going to use all of these techniques and I'm going to tell my audience that Hellenism stands in opposition to Judaism. So it's quite ironic that he's using these techniques and then saying, no, that Hellenism and Judaism cannot coexist. And again, this is not organic to diasporan Jewish thinking. The vast majority of Jews, as we've discussed over the past few weeks, certainly thought that you could be pious in the diaspora, observe dietary law, circumcision, and Sabbath, and also embrace aspects of Hellenistic thinking. And this author says something new. This author says that's impossible. You can't. Now, that's not representative of the majority of Jewish thinking. It's not. This is liminal. In other words, we all think, oh yeah, well, obviously, you know, Hanukkah is about the culture clash of Judaism and Hellenism. That is not how most Jews thought. So what we have in 2 Maccabees is an atypical work making an argument that doesn't get immediate traction, but ultimately becomes very influential. It's one of my favorite works. I don't mean to denigrate it in any way. I think it's stunningly written. And it preserves stories that are very, very famous, maybe most famously the story of the mother of seven sons, who later in the early medieval period becomes identified with Hannah, but she's not named. So this is the earliest iteration of that story of the mother and her martyred seven sons. And so there are stories in 2 Maccabees that certainly find expression in later literature among Jews and Christians. So it ends up being enormously influential. So with all of that introduction, let's look at the text. And now I'm going to share my screen. Okay. All right. So here we have 1 Maccabees, a straightforward, albeit biased, history, late second century BC. Now, again, if you were in my Hanukkah class in December, some of this might seem familiar to you, but today I'm going to try to get more into the text than I did in the December class. So I don't want you to think 1 Maccabees is boring and 2 Maccabees is interesting. 1 Maccabees contains poetry. It is very elegantly written. And you might notice, if you've already read this, some of you have been reading texts in advance of the class, that it almost seems very biblical. There are allusions to biblical practice in the first temple period. There are allusions to biblical figures. For example, when Matityahu is gathering followers at the beginning of the rebellion against Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who has in 175 BCE prohibited the observance of Jewish ancestral law, he says exactly what the Levites say following the incident of the golden calf, when the Levites kill a few thousand Israelites in Exodus 32 or maybe 33. He says, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me." This is a paraphrase of that story. The writer's not stupid, right? And it's not coincidental that Matityahu here is being depicted as the most pious of that, you know, the priestly community, preserving the integrity of the community. You know, one thing I noticed just now that I have not done for you is I haven't really laid out the nature of the conflict. And I don't want to spend, I could easily spend a half an hour telling you exactly what's going on here and why this conflict occurred. But I do want to parenthetically just say a couple things. The best argument for the fact that this is not a culture clash is that Alexander the Great dies in 323 BCE and Jews live under Hellenism for 150 years before any war occurs. So something okay is happening under Hellenism, you know, that they're able to do that. But there are also different Hellenistic empires. Again, you know, I've said this so many times, but it really bears repeating. So I'm going to say it again. When Alexander the Great dies, his empire is divided into three major parts. The Ptolemies take North Africa. The Seleucids take the northern Levant, like modern day Lebanon, Turkey, Syria. And the Antiochids take the East Asia. Now, Judea is right in the middle of all of this. It's prime real estate. It's a trade route. Everybody wants Judea. It's the center, the right in the middle of these three kingdoms. Now, in the third century BCE, Judea is primarily under the Ptolemaic kingdom. And things are, for the most part, okay under the Ptolemaic rule. Now, there are some hiccups, but most of the time, the Ptolemies let the Judeans do what they want and serve in their temple freely. In 200 BCE, Judea comes under control of the Syrian Greeks. And that's when the Seleucids, and that's when the trouble begins. So the conflict isn't against all Hellenism everywhere. The conflict has something to do with the particular nature of the northern Seleucid Greek kingdom led by Antiochus the Great, Antiochus the Third, at the beginning of the second century BC, and then his son Antiochus IV Epiphanes. So something happens with Antiochus IV Epiphanes, who in 175 is a new ruler in the sense that his ancestors did not have control over Judea in that region of the world. And Antiochus IV Epiphanes prohibits the observance of ancestral law. Now, it's a major debate among scholars why Antiochus IV Epiphanes does this. Is he responding to internal Judean infighting? Or is he so insistent that the Jews abandon their ancestral laws and assimilate like everybody else is doing? It just makes him so crazy that he's like, all right, I'm going to kill you if you keep observing the Sabbath. It's probably a combination of both things. Okay, so with that background, they're under new rule, right? The Jews have been used to living under Ptolemaic rulership, which has given them what we would call religious freedom. Now, under the Seleucids, things are very, very bad. And if they observe their ancestral law, they are risking being executed. So that's the premise of the story. We all, not all of us, but many of us have learned it as young children, but it is important to keep in mind, these are not all the Greeks. This is one of three major Greek empires in the world, but this story is very specific to the nature of the Seleucid kingdom. Okay. So Matityahu is talking like a Levite. He's talking like, a biblical hero. Let everyone who is zealous for the law, and that in Hebrew would be Torah, but in Greek would be nomos, but he's, you know, I think that this would probably be law in Hebrew, and supports the covenant, come out with me. Now, this is a very important passage that I want to spend a few minutes on, because this passage that I'm about to describe to you suggests that 1 Maccabees is very anti-martyrdom. And this is a profound difference between one Maccabees and two Maccabees. And it suggests that there's a live debate in the second century BC among Jews regarding what their attitude towards martyrdom should be. So one Maccabees, absolutely anti-martyrdom. You do not sacrifice your body unless you absolutely have to in the name of God. Two Maccabees is super pro-martyrdom, martyrdom all the way. And by the way, the early church fathers adored two Maccabees and cite two Maccabees and co-opt it as a sort of proto-Christian story, depicting the Hasmonean family as foreseeing the coming of Jesus. That's how much that they loved these figures. So two Maccabees is very, very pro-martyrdom. But listen to this story. This is a very anti-martyrdom. Again, it suggests a live debate among Jews that the rabbis ultimately settled. The rabbis are anti-martyrdom unless you're being asked to murder or have an inappropriate sexual relation, or what's the last one? People are mouthing and I can't remember.
Idolatry.
And then somebody has to unmute themselves. I'm having a brain freeze.
Worship idols.
Chat, please. Now I have to check the chat.
Idolatry.
Okay, it's gonna come to me, or somebody put it in the chat. Murder, inappropriate sexual relation, idolatry. See, that's the one that's not, you know, it's like, doesn't feel so relevant to the 21st century, but yes, idolatry. Thank you so much. Okay. We all have brain freezes sometimes. Okay, so listen to this story. So Matityahu cries out saying, everybody follow me if you support the law. Great. At that time, many who were seeking righteousness and justice went to the wilderness because troubles pressed heavily upon them. And these people were pursued, right? And the enemy encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. And the enemy said to them, enough of this, come out and do what the king commands and you'll live. So just abandon your ancestral law. The enemy quickly attacked them on the Sabbath, but they didn't answer them or even hurl a stone at them or block up their hiding places. For they said, let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly, not just because they're in a war, but because these people are capitalizing on their piety, on these Jews' piety, because they're keeping the Sabbath. So the enemy attacks them on the Sabbath and they died with their wives and children and livestock to the number of 1,000 people. 1,000 Jews early on in the war say, we're not going to fight back, and they let themselves be killed. This, there's no reason to assume this did not happen, right? One Maccabees, for the most part, is historically accurate. This is an account of the war. You could take this as, you know, this is a horrible tragedy. Maybe it wasn't 1,000. We don't know the exact number, but I would take this as, you know, reliable. Matityahu and his friends learn for it, and they're like, this is, you know, absolutely not just horrible because they died, but it was preventable, which makes it all the more tragic. So they make a decision that day. Let us fight against anyone who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our kindred died in their hiding places. And there, united with them, a company of Hasidim. Now, Hasidim does not mean like the 18th century Eastern European Hasidim, but just very, very pious Jews, mighty warriors of Israel. So here, there's some kind of sectarian community known as Hasidim, who are both pietists and warriors, and they offer themselves willingly for the law. They organize an army. They support Matityahu. And this community fights on the Sabbath, which you might think, whoa, that's like completely not what we would call from, right? That's not like the pious, observant way. And this book says, no, that's exactly what you do when your life is being threatened. You do not martyr yourself if you can prevent it. But now look at what this community of rebels do. And this is the part that's not so pretty. That's not so feel good. This is the part that maybe our children don't learn in Jewish day school. The Hasmoneans and their supporters circumcised forcibly all the uncircumcised boys that they'd found in the borders of Israel. They hunted down the arrogant, and the work prospered in their hands. So who are they really looking for? Who's their enemy? Well, you know, they're fighting the Syrian Greeks, but their other enemy are those Jews who are not willing to risk themselves by observing their ancestral laws. And so those people, the Hasmoneans, find their sons and circumcise them by force, which is really quite violent if you think about that. They rescued the lot of the hands of the Gentiles and the kings, and they never let the sinner gain the upper hand. And I love the ambiguity of this sentence, because who is the sinner? Is it the Gentile or is it the uncommitted Jew? So I think it's meant to be ambiguous. I don't think it's meant to be one or the other. Okay. Now here, I added a little bit more than what's on the source sheet on the website, because this morning I was just reading through these books and I was like, there's so many golden nuggets. I just kept adding and adding. So this is like an expanded version of the source sheet online. I wanted to add this speech, this deathbed speech that Matitiao gives to his sons, because it's so biblical. The writer here is so attentive to the Tanakh. He's probably reading his Torah in Hebrew. Because remember, this work is written in Hebrew. And so he really knows his scriptures, he knows his text, and he alludes to it. It's very important that this story take on biblical significance. And he says on his deathbed to his sons early on in the book, remember the deeds of the ancestors, which they did in their generations. You will receive great honor and everlasting name. Was not Abraham faithful when tested? Right? Joseph, in the time of his distress, kept the commandment and was rewarded. Pinchas, our ancestor, was deeply zealous, receiving the covenant of everlasting priesthood. And again, all these figures have some kind of association with the Hasmoneans, right? Pinchas with the priesthood and the zealousness, Abraham being tested and so on. Yoshua, because he fulfilled the command, became a judge. So your sacrifice today will ultimately bring you reward. And almost every major figure, or many of the major figures of the Tanakh, with the exception actually of Moshe, which always intrigued me, is mentioned here. You sons are like these individuals, these famous individuals who stood up for the law when nobody else would. And so observe from generation to generation, none of those who put their trust in him will lack strength. And then he dies. He blesses them. He's gathered his ancestors, which means he died. So this is not in your source sheet, but I thought it was very profound because it's very, very biblical. In the second century BCE, this would have meant something to a Jew who's reading their scriptural texts. I added a little more here from chapter 3, because even though we think of 1 Maccabees as being maybe a little bit more technical, a little more historical and sort of getting into the detail rather than waxing theological, it also includes beautiful Hebrew poetry. So look at this description of Judah Maccabee. And again, we have scholars who've reverse translated this back into the Hebrew, but we don't have the original Hebrew. So you could get a hold of Hebrew 1 Maccabees. It's even more beautiful in the Hebrew. Judah was a lion. And of course, we know about the association of Judah and Yehuda and the lion in Genesis. He was a lion in his deeds, like a lion's cub roaring for prey. He searched out and pursued those who broke the law. He burned those who troubled his people. So it's not very pretty, but it's quite poetic. He embittered many kings. He made Jacob glad by his deeds. And of course, there's this wordplay where Judah is both the biblical Judah, the son of Jacob of Genesis, and also the Judah of the Maccabean family. He went through cities of Judah. He destroyed the ungodly out of the land. He was renowned to the ends of the earth. He gathered in those who were perishing. So very, very biblical. Okay. All right. I want to make sure we have time for 2 Maccabees, but feel free to read all of this on your own. I underlined a few other words where it seems like Judah really is this Moses figure himself, even though Matitiah doesn't mention Moshe in his speech. Look at the way Judah speaks, right? So first he says, whoever is for God, come with me. And he says, arm yourselves and be courageous. Chazak ve'amatz is something that is told to Joshua, to Yehoshua in Numbers. And then God tells this to Yehoshua over and over in the beginning of the book of Yehoshua, of Joshua. And so again, this is a phrase that's biblical. Be strong and courageous is a biblical phrase that harkens back to the earlier biblical stories. And so he absolutely is fashioned in the same form of these earlier biblical figures. The holiday itself is not called Hanukkah. It's unclear what this holiday is. And again, this is the only eyewitness to the story. But when the temple is restored in Kislev, in 164 BCE, 148th year is counting down from the beginning of the Seleucid era. So that isn't going to mean anything to us if we're counting in our calendar, in our Gregorian calendar. So at the very season, on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it, it was dedicated as a Thanksgiving offering. 2 Maccabees is going to associate this holiday with Sukkot, with tabernacles, but we don't see that explicitly here. Judah and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at the season, the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days, beginning with the 25th day of the month of Kislev. So again, Hanukkah is a rabbinic term. We don't see that word here, but it seems that the establishment of the holiday for perpetuity occurs immediately. All right. So I'm going to move on, I think. Okay, to two Maccabees. So one Maccabees, again, very technical, very focused on the adventures and heroism of Judah and his family, a very practical anti-martyrdom, very pragmatic. How do we, the story is that how do we restore the self, maybe not restore the autonomy, but restore the freedom of the people living in Judea. And it's also a regional clash. Two Maccabees transforms this into a universal clash. This is not simply a story of the regional Jews in Judea, specifically in Jerusalem, fighting valiantly against the Syrian Greeks, but this is a universal clash, which means every Jew has a stake in it, including the diasporan audience reading this book. So the message being everyone has a stake in the story. This is a story about how God cares for all the Jewish people and saves them from Hellenism, Hellenismos, Judaismos being in existential opposition to Hellenismos. Again, these are words that the author makes up. And then later, much later, they catch on. So the story is introduced really with a focus on the temple, not the family of the Hasmoneans. The family of Hasmoneans, they're mediums, they're tools that God uses, but the focus is on the welfare of the temple. So the story of Judah Maccabeus and his brothers and the purification of the great temple and the dedication of the altar and the wars against Antiochus Epiphanes and his son Jupiter and the appearances that came from heaven to those who fought bravely for Judaism, not a word that we see in other texts. So that few in number, they seized the whole land, pursued the barbarian hordes, and regained possession of the temple, famous throughout the world. Already you can see the sentences in 2 Maccabees do not end. The style is totally different. This is Hellenistic style. The Hebrew of 1 Maccabees is terse and almost biblical, rhythmic and poetic to be sure, but very digestible. It almost reads like biblical verses. This is Greek through and through. There's no way that this text could have possibly been originally written in Hebrew. The appearances that came from heaven to those who fought bravely for Judaism, so those few in number, they seized the whole land and pursued the, I mean, on and on and on and on. The whole book is like this. And remember what I've said about this Greek word barbaros, barbarian. It really means, it's so used ironically in this work because Baros in Greek is a non-Greek speaker. So anyone who doesn't speak Greek sounds like this. Bada, 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 bada. So it's a non-Greek speaker. And here, again, there's so much irony in this work. The author is saying, who is the barbarian? Who is the foreigner? Well, it's the Greeks themselves. The Jews aren't the foreigners. We belong. You are the foreigners, the barbarian hordes who don't belong. But of course, they're the Greek speakers. So it's a very clever way of using that word. Okay, all of this has been set forth by Jason of Cyrene in five volumes. We'll try to condense it into a single work. It's just so loquacious. I mean, I love this work, but it could be a little hard to read. For considering the flood of statistics involved and the difficulty there is for those who wish to enter upon the narratives of history because of the massive material, we've aimed to please those who wish to read to make it easy for those who are inclined to memorize and to profit all readers. Whew. For as the master builder of a new house must be concerned with the whole construction, while the one who undertakes its painting and decoration has to consider only what is suitable for its adornment, such in my judgment is the case with us. So he takes only like the stuff necessary. I mean, if that's the case, then I don't know what the original five books looked like. So again, I'm not going to go through this in the detail that I would like, but there are a few things that I want to focus on. Do you remember how in the Greek version of Esther, it opens up with a little vignette that tells us the entire story? In the Greek version of Esther, Mordechai has a dream, and there are two dragons battling, and they're battling against each other, and then one is victorious over the other. And then at the very end of Greek Esther, Mordechai's like, I got it, I figured out the dream. It's like, wasn't that hard to understand, Mordechai, but okay. Mordechai's like, wow, okay, so one dragon was the Jews, and the other dragon was everybody else, and the victorious dragon was a symbol of the Jews. Great. So this is a Greek technique, and we see it in 2 Maccabees as well. It opens up with a story that tells us the entire narrative arc. And the story is that there is a general named Heliodorus who decides that he's going to invade the temple treasury of Jerusalem. And so the opening vignette here is Heliodorus is coming into Jerusalem and he's about to invade the Holy Temple, and he's going to take all the money from Jerusalem, and everybody freaks out. So listen to this very Hellenistic description of the invasion of Heliodorus into the temple. Again, you would never find this in 1 Maccabees. Do you see where I am? I'm highlighting. There was no little distress throughout the whole city. The priests prostrated themselves before the altar in their priestly vestments and called towards heaven upon him who had given the law about deposits, that he should keep them safe for those who had deposited them. That just means temple funds. To see the appearance of the high priest was to be wounded at heart. So Hellenistic. For his face and the change of his color disclosed the anguish of his soul. And you can imagine this being performed on a Greek stage. But again, the Greek stylistics are deployed to make an argument against all things that are Greek. For terror and bodily trembling had come over the man, which plainly showed to those who looked upon him the pain lodged in his heart. Again, this is absolutely one of my most favorite books ever. I mean, this is just like unbelievable. People are hurrying out of their houses in crowds to make a general supplication because the holy place was about to be brought into dishonor. So everyone's freaking out, running to the streets, begging God. And again, they're stage managing here, right? They're stage direction, almost as if the author thought maybe this will be performed. Holding their hands up to heaven, they all made supplication. There was something pitiable in the prostration of the whole populace and the anxiety of the high priest in his great anguish. So while they're all flipping out, Heliodorus is like, you know what? I'm going to go on with what has been decided. And he gets to the treasury with his bodyguard. And there, the sovereign of spirits and of all authority caused so great a manifestation that all who had been so bold as to accompany him were astounded by the power of God. In other words, there was a vision. What's the vision? What's the vision that freaks Heliodorus out? There appears to him and his bodyguards a magnificently caparisoned horse with a rider of frightening mien. Now, these are angel horses. It rushes furiously at Heliodorus and struck at him with his front hooves. Its rider was seen to have armor and weapons of gold. Okay, so this angel horse starts attacking them or heading towards them. Meanwhile, two young men also appear to him, remarkably strong, gloriously beautiful, and splendidly dressed, who stood on either side of him and flogging continuously. So two like super good looking angels are beating him up while a horse is attacking him. And this is all like, these are all visions, right? These are manifestations of something sent from on high. He falls to the ground, deep darkness comes over him. His men take him up, put him on a stretcher and carry him away. They clearly recognize the sovereign power of God. And so of course what we have here is really a foreshadowing of the entire story, because what's the message? Even if you have the Hashmonaim and you have Judah and you have his brothers and you have his father and you have his followers, really what this all is a miracle, right? You have an invasion of the temple that defiles the temple. You have a salvation here in this little vignette that's effected by a miracle. So too, I would argue that this imperfect metaphor for the whole story suggests that the Hasmonean war really is a representation, really is a reflection of God's divine intervention. So again, this is a little vignette at the beginning of the story, but if you look at it as a foreshadowing of the whole story, I think you get a very clear message that all of this comes from God. So on that day, when Heliodorus tried to invade the temple, he was unsuccessful. And then the real story of the war begins, but not before the author tells us that Heliodorus offered sacrifices to the Lord, made great vows to the savior of his life, and then went on his merry way. Now I want to go to the middle of the book to talk about martyrdom, because martyrdom maybe today might seem like a marginal topic that isn't so foundational to understanding the story. But really, it's massively important, because the question for Jews reading these stories is, so what do we learn from these? You know, if we're in a crisis, to what extent do we fight? And to what extent do we allow ourselves to hold on to our ancestral laws, even if that means death? So again, I've mentioned 1 Maccabees is very explicitly anti-martyrdom. And the writer of 2 Maccabees has a totally different orientation towards this issue. So we have the very famous story of the mother of 7 sons. We also have, I have it here. We also have the story of an individual named Elazar who martyrs himself. But before I get there, I want to go to chapter 6, verse 12. So by chapter 6, things are a disaster. Everything is going wrong. The Jews are on the brink of annihilation. Things are really, really looking bleak. And the author pauses. Now, whether this is the condenser or Jason, we do not know. But the author pauses to editorialize on how he understands the importance of this story. And this is what he said. Again, it's so Hellenistic. Now I urge those who read this book not to be depressed by such calamities. And I love this theologizing because it's quite rare in Second Temple literature that we have such explicit editorializing. Don't be depressed, but recognize that these punishments were designed not to destroy, but to discipline. And that is very Stoic, very, very Stoic thinking. Suffering is purifying. In fact, it is a sign of great kindness, not to let the impious alone for long, but to punish them immediately. So in other words, if the Jews were not punished for their sins now, they would be punished in perhaps, you know, the world to come or following their death or at a later time, and it would be much worse. For in the case of the other nations, the Lord waits patiently to punish them until they've reached the full measure of their sins. And then he annihilates them, presumably. But he doesn't deal in this way with us in order that he should not take vengeance on us afterwards when our sins have reached their height. Therefore, God never withdraws his mercy from us. And although he disciplines us with calamities, he never forsakes his own people. This comes in the middle of the story, and this is maybe the most important passage in the whole book, because this passage tells us how to understand the crisis. It is not reflective of God's rejection of the people, as later Christians would suggest, but it is reflective of God's everlasting love, that God refuses to annihilate the people and so doesn't wait for their sins to accumulate. And with this, the author proceeds to two martyrdom accounts. And at least the second one, the story of the mother of the seven sons, which is so very famous and powerful in our later imagination, probably is not original to the author. So probably the author had this story and borrowed it and refashioned it. The first is the story of Elazar. I'm not going to spend so much time on this story. It is the less famous one, but Elazar is a great pious man, and he refuses to violate his ancestral law, and so he is killed on the rack. When he's about to die under the blows, he groans aloud and says, "It's clear to the Lord in his holy knowledge that I might have been saved from death. Though I might have been saved from death, I'm enduring terrible sufferings in my body under this beating, but in my soul I'm glad." Right? This is an explicit affirmation of a positive attitude towards martyrdom. Excuse me for a second. An example of nobility and a memorial of courage, not only to the young, but to the great body of his nation. Okay. But now here's the real, this is the crown jewel of the story. The crown jewel of the story is the mother of the seven sons. This is an expanded novella almost. So, you know, when we did a few weeks ago, we talked about novellas in the Second Temple period, and we talked about these female protagonists. So Judith and Esther and Susanna. This chapter, which is very expanded, very long, could be taken as a novella with a female protagonist that occurs right in the middle of two Maccabees. But I am not convinced that the author invents this story. I think that it, as other scholars do, I think that it comes from other, from another source, but he refashions it and incorporates it. So it also happened, and she's not named, so we're not going to say Hannah. It also happened that seven brothers and their mother were arrested and were being compelled by the king under torture with whips and thongs to partake of unlawful swine's flesh. One of them, acting as their spokesman, said, "What do you intend to ask and learn from us? For we're ready to die rather than transgress the laws of our ancestors." Now, remember when I said, although I forgot one of them, remember when I said in the rabbinic period, you are not allowed to martyr yourself unless you're being forced to murder, be involved in some kind of sexually prohibited activity, or commit idolatry. But what that means is that in the rabbinic period, you have to eat the cheeseburger, right? So if somebody says, "I'm going to kill you," or "eat the cheeseburger," you're like, "Bring it on. Like, where is that cheeseburger? I will eat it." So this is in direct contrast with later rabbinic law, because what they're being asked to do is not commit adult idolatry. A lot of people think that about the story. A lot of people think, oh, he put an idol in front of them. But they're being asked to eat pork. Pork being, by the way, in the Roman period, the most popular of all meats. So more than anything, more than beef or chicken or whatever, the Romans ate pork. They thought it was crazy that the Jews did not eat pork. They thought it was very silly and irrational. Okay, so If you're wondering what the origins are of the tradition to eat oily food, I would suggest perhaps it's not related to the miracle of the oil, which does not appear in 1 Maccabees or 2 Maccabees, but might be related to the fact that these children are fried alive. Now, that's me being very macabre and sort of tongue-in-cheek, but this is the only time we see oil being used in the story. So they are fried in a pan. I'm not going to get into the tortures. You could read them yourself. Again, very, very, very Hellenistic. But I want to get to something fascinating. This is really incredible passage that I'm bringing you to now. Resurrection is not an idea that is well developed in the Hebrew Bible at all. You see allusions to it in Yechezkel, one possible allusion to it in Daniel. It is not a well-developed idea in the Tanakh. It's not even a well-developed idea in the Second Temple period. It's very foundational to rabbinic thinking. So I don't want you to think that 2 Maccabees is the opposite of all rabbinic things. In the topic of martyrdom, it is. But look at what the mother says to her son. This is one of the earliest and clearest articulations of resurrection that survive. The mother was especially admirable and worthy of honorable memory. Although she saw her 7 sons perish in a single day, she bore with good courage. She encouraged each of them in the language of their ancestors. She spoke to them in Hebrew. This story tells us in Greek. Filled with a noble spirit, she reinforced her woman's reasoning. Well, it's Women's International Day, so I don't know. We're just going to leave that aside. She reinforced her woman's reasoning with a man's courage. I do not know how you came into being in my womb. It was not I who gave you life and breath, nor I who set in order the elements within each of you. The creator of the world, who shaped the beginning of humankind and devised the origin of all things, will in his mercy give life and breath back to you again. And again, when she's speaking to the youngest child, she leans close to him and speaks in her native tongue in Hebrew. And she derides the cruel tyrant in Hebrew. My son, have pity on me. I carried you for 9 months in my womb. I nursed you for 3 years. I've reared you and brought you up to this point in your life. I beg you, my child, look at the heaven, the earth, and see that everything is in them. Recognize that God did not make them out of things that existed, right? Everything's created out of nothing, ex nihilo, in the same way the human race came into being. I mean, this philosophical passage is not just a story about martyrdom. This is not just a story about a mother encouraging her 7 sons to be cruelly and horribly executed. This is a story which makes an argument for how Jews believe that the universe came into being, that humanity came into being, and how they believe their creator God is the one and only true God that created the world from nothing. This is a live philosophical debate among Stoic philosophers in the 2nd century BCE. So again, the author is engaging with philosophical questions using Hellenistic techniques to make an argument against Greek philosophers and Greek literary writers to say, I'm going to use all of your techniques, and now I'm going to tell you that you're all wrong. Not only are you all wrong, but what you stand for, Hellenismus, is in direct opposition to everything that I stand for, Judaismus. So it is a theological clash. It is an unavoidable clash, and you have to choose a side. Okay, I've included in the source sheet some other sources that you might be interested in looking at. These are the 2 letters at the beginning of 2 Maccabees that talk about the observance of Hanukkah that are late 2nd century BC that were appended to the book in the 1st century BC. You could look at how Josephus talks about Hanukkah. He has no idea why it's called the Holiday of Lights, which I think is really interesting. There's no reference to the miracle of the oil. So I just include additional sources. If you're interested, there's some really fascinating stuff, in my opinion, but I don't want that to be the focus of today's class because we have to stay grounded in the Apocrypha. I have not read any of your comments. We have 152 people on this call. One of the very, very nice things, by the way, of teaching this course is getting emails throughout the week. I really don't have time to answer everybody right away, but I like hearing from you. And so if I don't address your questions or comments, you can always email me. But we've done something risky in the past that has worked, which is if you have a question right now, just unmute yourself, because I don't want to waste your time reading all of these comments, but I do want to hear from you. So you can email them to me or just unmute yourself and hopefully we won't be talking over each other. So it's a risk, but I think we could do it. So any questions, just unmute yourself. Otherwise, I'm going to waste your time and I'm going to read all of these. The rabbinic sages mentioned in that book appear in these books.
Can you put your email address in the chat, please?
Any questions as I read?
Your email address, please.
How did the Israelites survive from Yoshua till now without fighting in Shabbat? Well, we don't know that all Jews in all times were refusing to wage war in Shabbat. We don't know that. We just simply don't have the evidence to say that one way or another.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, yes, Mar'e Kohen, right? Gershon Hefner. To see the appearance of the high priest, Yom Kippur is Mar'e Kohen. I've thought of that connection. It's unbelievable. Oh, wait, no, I can't hear you.
Can I ask a question? Do you hear me?
Yes. You know what? Okay. That's so funny, because I have to just say, I was wondering why there was no background noise and everyone was like, tell people to mute. It was my problem on my end. I could not hear you. Now I fixed it. Thank you, Brenda.
Okay. Okay, so it has nothing to do with Maccabees. It has to do with something you talked about a few weeks ago. You said that Kashrut and Shabbat was common to all Jews all over the world. And then you said, someone asked about mikvah, and you said, not now, you'll get to it. So when did mikvah become common to all Jews?
So the purity laws are very important in Judea. We know this from archaeological evidence. We have the immersion pools. We have the mikvaot that have been excavated, and some of these date to the Second Temple period. So that's...
Excuse me, even earlier in Shiloh. Has water underneath, so that in the tell there.
Okay. I mean, I wasn't saying from earlier, but...
But that predates even the First Temple.
Predates the First Temple?
Shiloh, of course.
But immersion pool?
Ishtan was before the First Temple.
I'm aware of that, but are there mikvahs?
Yes, there's water all over. It's not a classic tale. I live in Shiloh.
Okay, I didn't know about mikvahs in Shiloh, but the fact is that
Shiloh is actually what looks like a tale is over water storage. And there are signs of mikvahot, and that's Mishkan.
I don't know if these mikvahs were used specifically for women. They might have been used for priests.
The point
that Second Temple mikvahs, do you know what they were used for? They were used for priests, we know.
Men absolutely used the mikvahs. We know that because there are 10 mikvahs found in Qumran. So it certainly was not exclusively or even primarily for women. The point that I would want to make right now is that in excavations of diasporan communities, we don't have that number of mikvahs. If you're sending me private messages, I can't read them right now, but feel free to email me. So it seems to be that in the diasporan communities, those purity immersion practices were not foregrounded in the way that they were in Judean communities.
Mm-hmm.
That's the point that I want to make. Yeah.
Interesting.
Malka, if I may make a correction, please. You mentioned the three cardinal sins for which Yehareg B'al Yavor. However, Bishat Hashmad, any Gezerah would be a reason for martyrdom.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. That's interesting. But again, you know, there's no evidence that in the Second Temple period that was part of the discourse, even though it would have been a Shad Hashmad, a time of existential crisis, a time when there was a question of the survival of the Jewish people. So is that, I don't know if that would have entered into the conversation at this very early stage, but thank you for bringing it in. All right, now that I can hear you, any other questions?
So is the Chana story the mother and her seven sons story?
She becomes identified. It's a great question. She becomes identified much later. I don't, you know, I wouldn't say that there's any signs pointing to that association in the Second Temple period. But if you look at 2 Maccabees 7, there are so many compelling reasons to compare this with the figure of Hannah, who gives her son away, Shmuel. Obviously, he's not martyred, but who, you know, gives him back to God. That kind of level of sacrifice is extreme. You know, I don't know offhand exactly when this transition occurs, but I do know that my sister Yael Ziegler has given a really nice talk on this, and she has the sources. So I would be very happy to ask her for those sources.
Are there other paradigmatic stories just like that that occur over and over again, like mega stories or whatever they're called? So that it's just a recurring theme, just like Joseph has the suicide story and whatever, you know.
Yeah, actually, somebody was just telling me that they were at a regional meeting for the Society of Biblical Literature, and somebody brought up an ancient Near Eastern story that parallels 2 Maccabees 7. So, yeah, you know, you can find these tropes, but what's most interesting to me is how they're incorporated into very, very specific Jewish texts that are making a new argument.
The 8 days of celebration of the temple in 1 Maccabees has no explanation. Do you think they knew the story about Sukkot in the author of 1 Maccabees knew the story about?
Oh, you're coming in and out. Do they Sukkot. Know the story of, say that again?
I'm saying the 8 days of dedication of the temple in 1 Maccabees has no explanation, whereas it does in 2 Maccabees. Do you think 1 Maccabees was aware of the Sukkot explanation?
So that's a big question. This was the topic of my discussion in the December talk. You know, we don't know. The letters that are appended to 2 Maccabees also make a connection with Sukkot. But the second letter is most interesting because it argues that the holiday actually precedes the war and argues that there was a holiday celebrated at this time of year going all the way back into the time of Nehemiah that was associated with some miraculous light that Nehemiah had gotten some hidden fire from the altar that derived from the first temple period, and he ignited it when he came back from exile and miraculously alit. And that was the origins of the story. So there's all kinds of traditions about the origins. Now, the question of 8 days, you know, you could also connect it to, and Yoel Ben Nun has written very interestingly on an older holiday connected with the Mishkan as articulated in the book of Zechariah. And so that is also, I think, very important to take into account. All of this, you know, with 2 minutes left, is to say that there were Jews in the middle of the second century BC who viewed the holiday as preceding the war, but then taking on new significance. So that there was something older that had been observed and commemorated, and now there's a new reason to celebrate at that time. So yeah, Yoel Ben Nun's article has been translated, I think, by Karen Fish. I think it's online on the VBM website. Rushane is nodding. So it's very fascinating. I wasn't planning on discussing it today, but I would recommend it highly.
Thank you.
The rabbis from Pirkei Avot, they must have lived in this time. Did they have any involvement in the story brought to the Maccabees?
So we know a little bit about Shimon ben Shetach. We know that according to the rabbis, he's the brother of Salome Alexandra, who's married to Alexander Janaeus, who's a very notorious king in the early first century BCE, and obviously considered quite an evil Hasmonean, a Hellenized Hasmonean who crucified 800 Pharisees. So we have some associations between the rabbis, the early rabbis, and the Hasmonean dynasty, but the earliest associations that would appear in the writings of Josephus, meaning we have a few allusions to these figures in Josephus's history of the Hasmonean family, but not in this early stage in the apocryphal writings of 2 Maccabees.
I would like to know when exactly, you know, if this writer sort of coined Hellenism and Judaism and it didn't catch on right away, when did it start to come into the lexicon?
It's a massively controversial question. If you ask Daniel Boyarin, he'll say the 4th century. I would put it much earlier. Here's the question. if you are not using a word, does that mean that the concept doesn't exist? Like, I don't care so much that Judaism is not a word that appears in Jewish literature. What worries me is that then there are scholars saying, because the word isn't used until the fourth century, you can't speak about Judaism until the fourth century. There's a lot at stake in this question, and it's a very sort of complicated theoretical, you know, what comes first, ideas or language. But I would say, you know, the fact is we don't have this word. We don't have the word in Greek. We don't have the word in Hebrew until much later, until the fourth century in inscriptions, in fourth century, like tombstone inscription. So, you know, I think that for me, it's, I put the notion, the category of Judaism much earlier. I'll put some names in the chat box of scholars I think have written very well on this. I think Daniel Schwartz has written very well. He has a book called Jews, Judeans, and Judaism or something. Shia Cohen has written on this. I think he takes a really reasonable middle ground. John Collins has a little bit in his introduction, The Invention of Judaism. I hate that title, The Invention of Judaism. It's like it came out of nowhere in the first century. And then, you know, Dana Boyarin, Steve Mason, not scholars I totally agree with, but very important for understanding the conversation. But yeah, the fact of the matter is this is not a word that you see in except in 2 Maccabees and 4 Maccabees in all of Second Temple Jewish literature. And 4 Maccabees is using 2 Maccabees. So 2 Maccabees certainly is using it sort of inventively. But the invention of Judaism as a concept is a different question. All right, well, I'm gonna say goodbye to everybody. I'm sorry about my technical difficulties where I wasn't hearing you. And you know, I'm always available to correspond over email. And I'll see you for the last class of the series. A week from today, we'll be talking about wisdom literature.
Thank you, have a good week.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.